In the infinite inning, you can get it right, or almost right, without getting it as right as you need it to be, which is to say that defeat will be snatched from the jaws of victory. I have two examples of this in mind today. One is right-handed pitcher Andy Hawkins. In December of 1988, the Yankees blew away the competition to sign the San Diego Padres free agent right-hander to a three-year, $3.6 million deal. And manager Dallas Green announced that Hawkins would lead the rotation. And if you look at the coverage at the time, even then, people reporting on his comments said, "This brings up a lot of questions about the rest of the rotation." Hawkins was not an ace. He was a pitch-to-contact type who tended to walk about as many as he struck out. Well, the signing was a disaster. The Yankees, who were rebuilding at the time, actually they were still falling, never mind rebuilding, were not set up to support a pitch-to-contact guy. They didn't have the defense for it. And Hawkins really wasn't that good. He was skating by on park effects and good defense and the pitcher batting in the National League. He didn't quite make it through the 3 years before getting released. He pitched 66 times over that span, allowing a 5.21 ERA in 378.2 innings, which is even worse than it looks now, offense not being as high then as it is today. So it's a 76 ERA plus at Baseball Reference when you park and league adjust it. Many of you will have guessed where I'm going with this, which is that on July 1st, 1990, in a day game at Chicago, Hawkins pitched a no-hitter and lost. His final line reads like this: 8 innings, no hits, 4 runs, no earned runs, 5 walks, 3 strikeouts. He lost 4-0. The crucial inning was the bottom of the 8th, and with 2 outs in that frame, Sammy Sosa, just beginning his career then, reached on an error by the third baseman, Mike Blowers, who, in his own way, although he went on to do some better things with other teams, was one of the more disastrous Yankees ever, just in a very short term. Then Hawkins walked Ozzie Guillen and Lance Johnson, two guys who were very difficult to walk. They were hitters who liked to put the ball in play no matter what. That brought up a young Robin Ventura. Ventura lofted a fly ball to the left fielder, who was Jim Leyritz. Jim Leyritz in his career played a lot of positions. He played them in this order: catcher, DH, first base, third base, then outfield, then right field, then left field. He had some positives to him as a hitter, and he had some very valuable seasons as a platoon guy for the Yankees, but defensive left fielder really wasn't among his skills. Well, he dropped the fly ball. 3 runs scored. Ventura made second. Parenthetically, I would drop some audio of that game in here for you, but because that game took place in 1990, the media of choice for storage was videotape, and that stuff has about the lifespan of a carton of milk. So the sound quality on the recordings is actually worse than that of the Red Barber call from 1947 I gave you last week. As such, you'll just have to live with my desultory description of the game here. Back to it. The next batter, Yvon Calderon, hit a high fly ball to Jesse Barfield in right field. Now, Barfield was a very steady outfielder with a fantastic arm, but as will sometimes happen to even the best outfielders, he lost the ball in the sun. It dropped. Ventura scored. That was all the scoring in the game, and Hawkins lost. After, Hawkins said, "I'm stunned. I really am. This is not even close to the way I envisioned a no-hitter would be. You dream of one, but you never think it's going to be a loss. You think of Dave Stewart and Fernando Valenzuela coming off the field in jubilation. Not this." The New York Times talked to him the next day. He was feeling a little better. He said, "I got beaten. That stinks, but I still threw a no-hitter, and that will never be taken away from me." Wrong. A few years later, Major League Baseball issued a new definition of what a no-hitter is, and games like Hawkins, in which he pitched neither 9 innings nor 1, no longer qualified. So yes, it could in fact be taken away from him. There is no joy in Mudville. There never is joy in Mudville. Now, Hawkins contributed to his own downfall in that game with all the walks, particularly walking guys who you really had to make an effort to walk. But 3 errors in an inning are also 3 errors in an inning, and I don't think we can make him wholly responsible for those. But I was also thinking of an earlier player, Babe Herman. Babe Herman was a right fielder primarily for the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he was a tremendous hitter. When evaluating him, you have to keep in mind that he was playing in a tiny ballpark during a very high offense era, so you have to kind of mentally downgrade his numbers. But he was a left-handed hitter, and if you look at the overall results, which in most seasons are mid-range power but with a lot of doubles and triples and a high batting average, I suspect he was kind of like Paul O'Neill but without the defense. His best season in 1930, which is of course one of the all-time big offensive seasons, he hit .393, he slugged .678, he hit 48 doubles, 11 triples, 35 home runs. I think the year before, though, was more typical, also a big offensive year, .381 with a .612 slugging percentage, 42 doubles, 13 triples, 21 home runs. On a 162-game basis, this is all per Baseball Reference, he averaged .324 with 42 doubles, 11 triples, 19 home runs. So you see where I'm getting the Paul O'Neill idea from. But like I said, he didn't have the defense. He didn't have the intelligence as a player anyway. And he was famous for base running mishaps, for fielding fly balls off his shoulders. Well, I take that back. That's a misstatement. He was famous for fielding fly balls off his head. He insisted that he had never done that, but off his shoulders, yeah, maybe a few. It's worth pointing out that if Baseball Reference's numbers are to be trusted, his worst season in the outfield was worth a negative 14-run contribution, which is very bad, but is also not nearly as bad as, say, Matt Kemp was back in 2014 when he was worth minus 23, or for that matter, what Matt Kemp was worth in left field just this past season when he was worth negative 17. The compensatory thing was that Herman contributed a whole lot more with the bat than Matt Kemp, and he didn't live to know that there would be a Matt Kemp, but he resented the way that he was characterized in the press as a total goofball and someone who was responsible for a lot of losses just by being an idiot. And he would complain about that. Well, there's a story, and it's told in enough versions that I'm not going to quote you a specific one, just kind of give you a paraphrased version of it, that when he was with the Dodgers, he confronted one of the beat writers and said, "Look, I'm trying my best out there. You see what I can do. You're always putting me down in the papers. You're saying I'm eccentric. You're saying I don't know my left from my right. This is really not fair to me." And the beat writer said, "You know what, Babe?" Or maybe he said Floyd. That was his real name. "You know what, Floyd? You're right. You are not nearly as nutty as I have made you out to be. And I will endeavor to be fairer from now on." And Babe Herman said, "Thank you." And they shook on it. And as they turned to part, Babe reached into his pocket, pulled out a lit cigar, and began puffing on it. And the writer said, "Deal's off." And Herman was left standing there, cigar in his mouth, saying, "What?" I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Frank had dreamed of being a screenwriter his entire life, and when a bidding war erupted over a hidden wish, his not-so-hidden wish, was granted. The tale of the reformed hitman, who did whatever he could to grant the secret, unachieved desires of the downtrodden, the frustrated, the bitter, no matter how dark or how unspeakable, won no Oscars or plaudits from the critics, but it made about a half a billion at the global box office and made an action star of Johnny Gentle, who played the lead, Bronx Boy Velarde. Now, though, he was writing Hidden Wish 4, and he wanted to die. "Larry," he said to his agent, "I can't take another one of these. I'm sick of Bronx Boy Velarde. There are other stories I want to tell that I need to tell. We have wrung every last drop we can out of this concept. I'm sorry, Frank, Larry said. You're locked in. Well, at least get them to fire me so that someone else can finish this dog of a script. Frank, didn't you read the contract? You are signed through Hidden Wish 11. Johnny Gentle insisted on it. There was silence, and then the line went dead from Frank's end. The next day, they were to shoot the car chase scene from Hidden Wish 3, then in production even as 4 was being written, so safe an investment were both perceived to be. Johnny Gentle as Bronx Boy Velarde would play a game of chicken with an oncoming armored Yugo. At the last moment, the Yugo was to swerve aside. As always, Johnny insisted on doing his own stunts. The director shouted action, and the two cars revved and charged towards each other. The crew tensely counted down the moments until the Yugo made its last-minute swerve, as they had practiced it. 3, 2, no swerve. The head-on impact accordioned both cars. It took an hour to extricate the body of Johnny Gentle from his wrecked vehicle. How could Tom have done this? Said the director, referring to the stuntman who was to drive the Yugo. Did what? Tom said, stumbling onto the scene. Someone hit me over the head, and I've been unconscious this whole time. My God, who was driving the other car? Just then Larry the agent appeared. I can save you the trouble of taking it apart. It's Frank. He left a note. And a script. His hidden wish was for Johnny Gentle to be dead, for this series to end, and to write episode 45. And wouldn't you know, that's the one that won the Oscar. Welcome back to the show. I have for you today a very good, very frank discussion with my pal Howard Megdahl, who has written for just about everybody. This is a subject of our conversation. He hustles like no one else. But as a baseball writer, he has written a great deal about the Mets, including a book, Wilpon's Folly, which traces the fallout from the Madoff scandal as it impacts that baseball team, and the Cardinal Way, about the way the Cardinals go about their business. And Howard seemed like a good guy to talk to because, God knows, we've talked enough about the Mets on this show, and out of all proportion to the actual success of the Mets, but they're an object of infinite interest given what they pretend to be, which, as you'll hear me mention in the conversation, is a small market team that plays in New York. This is kind of like claiming you're the world's most undersized blue whale. This is, by definition, a contradiction in terms, and I assume that it's only because we've got so much other stuff to worry about that fans are not more outraged. We also have a frank discussion of the coverage of women's sports, and Howard's written a great deal about women's basketball, both at the professional and collegiate level, and women's soccer, and it's a really timely topic to take on, and he has a very good perspective on it. And I should also warn you that his current baby, 50 States of Blue, is an explicitly progressive website. And whereas I think by now, if you're in episode 45, you know where I stand on those things. I try not to be super explicit about it, but to underscore it in some of the morals that I've drawn from the baseball tales that I tell here. But even so, if one of my conversation partners being explicitly anti-Trump is not for you, you are going to be triggered today. Now, that aspect of the conversation takes place at the very end of the show. It's mostly safe for you to plow on through until then, but just be aware that this is something that is coming in this here baseball podcast. As I've said repeatedly, baseball is everything. Everything is baseball. Baseball takes place in the United States of America, and the United States of America is going through a very special time, and we would be very precious if we pretended that baseball existed in some sort of egg that is untouched by the stuff going on around us, and that we, when we are talking about baseball, exist in that egg as well. So, be ye warned. As for the rest, as for the story I usually tell in this segment, I'm going to keep the discussion brief, in part because I'm running spectacularly behind this week for reasons I can't completely explain, not because they're too private to explain, but because I don't totally understand it, and second, because what I have in mind to discuss is so dark that if I rushed through it and get it wrong, then A, I'm going to earn your ire, and B, if I get it wrong in this format, it's wrong forever. And so I'd rather take the time to get it right and talk to you about it next week. I've actually put off this topic a number of times because I don't quite know how to get it right. And I am conscious of the great responsibility that I have in that this show now reaches thousands of people at a shot, and it's very flattering and very encouraging, but I don't want to do or say anything irresponsible where any of you are concerned. You may also be able to hear my voice starting to go on me, which is yet another reason to keep things brief. I've made it to the tail end of this winter, when so many people were literally dropping dead from the flu, without having so much as a cold, maybe the odd sniffle here and there. And I don't mean to jinx myself, so knock wood in all that, but this does not bode well for a happy spring for me. It certainly doesn't bode well for podcasting. So I apologize for being vague about something I'm not even going to talk about this week, but stay tuned. And I'm also, for some reason, extra conscious of a line I came across looking up what I'm about to tell you about by the longtime St. Louis baseball columnist J. Roy Stockton, who was in this column criticizing Branch Rickey. This was in 1950, and Rickey was complaining about very often being misquoted. And Stockton came back at him by saying, "The trouble with you, Branch, is that you talk so much and say so little that almost invariably nobody knows what the hell you're talking about." Which is an interesting defense for misquoting somebody. "We didn't quite understand your point, so we just made something up." Well, fine. But I don't want to be like Branch in this instance. There are a lot of reasons to want to be like Branch Rickey, primarily his humanitarianism. His humanitarianism tinged with practicality, I would say. There's always an underside to things. But on this occasion, in honor of Mr. Stockton's line, I will keep things terse. And all I really want to do is ask you one question, kind of a silly question. But on June 7th, 1950, the St. Louis Browns, that is, the future Baltimore Orioles, came to Boston for a series with the Red Sox. The Red Sox were not going to be a pennant-winning club that year. They did turn out to have a very good offense. They were the last team to date to hit 300 as a roster. The Browns were not as bad as they usually were in this period, but they were still pretty damn bad. In the first game of the series on June 7th, it was a close game. The Red Sox only won it 20-4. So my first question is, if you're a hometown Red Sox fan, and you know that the next day they have another game scheduled with the same patsies, do you go out for it? Do you buy a ticket? Now, I will tell you that insofar as that first game went, that only, according to the box score, 6,659 came out in the first place. The idea that you might see the Red Sox score a couple of touchdowns and two field goals against the Browns was not attractive enough for too many Bostonians to come out whenever that game was being played. I'm not sure of the time of the game. I assume it was a day game. So, okay, the next day, they go out and they're going to do it again. Thursday, June 8th. And this time, it was even more of a squeaker. The Red Sox beat the Browns, are you ready for this? 29-4. They scored 8 in the second, 5 in the third, 7 in the fourth, 2 in the fifth. They took the sixth off. They scored 2 in the seventh and 5 in the eighth. There are a lot of things notable about this game. For one thing, the Red Sox didn't substitute out anybody. They just left the regulars in, and the starting pitcher, Chuck Stobbs, went all the way. And he walked 7 and allowed 8 hits. So he threw 1.5 million pitches in a game that he had won 2 hours earlier than when he finally walked off the mound. And let's mention that the time of game for all those runs being scored was 2 hours and 42 minutes. Whereas today, I assume that they'd have to get some kind of special dispensation to play it over a 72-hour period. Ted Williams, by the way, hit 2 home runs in that game. Walt Dropo also hit 2. Bobby Doerr hit 3 and drove in 8. 2 Red Sox, Johnny Pesky and Al Zarrilla, had 5-hit days. Both of them went 5-for-7. Now, in answer to the earlier question that I asked, the answer for Bostonians at that particular moment was no. You don't come out for a lopsided contest, even if you know ahead of time it's going to be a lopsided contest. Attendance for the second game was 5,105. So over 1,000 people stayed home as compared to the first game. But here's the question that I want to ask you, because I know as baseball fans, for a lot of us, this is a point of pride. Do you stay for the whole thing? By the end of the bottom of the fourth inning, the Red Sox were up a cool 20-3. This is the second day in a row that this has happened. You know that there is no comeback. You know, even today, if the Astros were down 20-3, if the Angels were down 20-3 and Mike Trout hadn't even batted yet, there's just no coming back. No one comes back from that. There are a few games in baseball history that have had that kind of score where both teams got into huge double figures by baseball standards and there was some seesaw aspect to it. And this sounds like kind of a joke, but I think that every game that meets that description where both teams scored over 20 runs was some kind of Phillies-Cubs game. You had to know if you were following the game at all at that time that the Browns were not going to answer to that. So do you stay? If I promised you that, like Boston manager Joe McCarthy, that, say, A.J. Hinch, if it were the Astros, would substitute no one, that you would get to see all the Jose Altuve and Carlos Correa at-bats, would you stay? I think I would. The disincentive is, like I said, that back then they hustled it along and they still got all of this done in under 3 hours. If you're staying for a 29-4 game today, you've made a commitment that pretty much excludes your doing anything else. I hate to give Rob Manfred any ammunition in his obsession with shortening game times at the expense of the quality of the game, and I'll tell you right now, if they start putting runners on base in extra innings, I am out of here. But as much as I love the game, I have found in this career of mine, you can have too much of a good thing sometimes. Well, you think that over. In the meantime, we'll take a quick break for a word from our sponsors, and then I'll be back with Howard Megdal. My next guest is editor-in-chief and founder of 50 States of Blue, which is political writing from the opposite side of the aisle. He's also the editor-in-chief of The Summit, summithoops.com, on the WNBA. He's a freelancer for too many publications to list, including Once Upon a Time for Me. I think the only thing I haven't seen him write is cooking tips, and for all I know, he's got that in the wings. He has also written the books The Cardinals Way, The Baseball Talmud, subtitled The Definitive Position-by-Position Ranking of Baseball's Chosen Players, Wilpon's Folly, and Taking the Field, A Fan's Quest to Run the Team He Loves, both of which pertain to the New York Mets. He is Howard Megdal. How are you, Howard?
I'm good, Steve. By the way, I have a piece in the works that's going to be not cooking-based, but I'm writing about food for the first time. to be announced in the next few weeks. So look for that coming up as well. I'm amused that you pointed that out.
I should have known better than to put anything by you. I will think of something even more esoteric next time. But that brings to mind this question. How do you do all this?
I don't really know the answer to that other than to say I don't really know how not to do all this. And I just, by way of explanation, I had somebody in the industry years ago in a very know-it-all fashion say to me, listen, you need to pick one thing and you need to stick with that for your personal brand. And it was just the worst advice I'd ever gotten from someone who did that and has slowly faded from the industry.
It wasn't me, was it?
It was not you. Certainly not. You of all people would never suggest that, I know. But it, what has happened over this period of time that I've been working is just that I have a lot of different areas that are of fundamental interest to me, that I have a curiosity that, to my mind, only doing the work of journalism allows me to satisfy. And so the idea that I would stick to one as opposed to another, you know, whether it's within sports, you know, picking a sport, or even just sticking to sports, as, you know, the hackneyed hashtag would have it, is just not something that I'd ever be comfortable doing.
So let me ask you about the origin of all that. Tell me if I'm wrong about this, but my first memory of meeting you, I think, was at an event that I did either for my Casey Stengel book or for some BP books at the Yogi Berra Museum. I remember you introducing yourself, this bespectacled tall fellow with a strong jaw, just very politely saying hello, and we probably chatted for a few minutes. And that might have happened more than one time. And not to be dismissive of you, but there were a few people in that category who would come to all the events, and that was my primary contact with them, just to say hello and, oh, it's a familiar face, isn't that nice? And then the next thing I know, your byline is everywhere. So am I remembering that correctly? And what transpired between your being just sort of, I assume, a younger reader at that time to someone who has established himself in so many multifarious ways?
So the easiest answer to that, yes, you remember that correctly. And you were writing, this sounds like I'm insulting you, and I hope I don't mean it. But I was reading the Pinstripe Bible when I was still in college. And so when I got out of school, I went to work for a paper in upstate New York, about an hour and a half away from the city, called the Hudson Register Star. By the time we met up in the early to mid aughts, I guess we'll call it, I had moved down. I met my wife in the Hudson Valley and moved down and was looking to break into the industry in various ways. And ultimately was doing that through freelancing, and then really how freelancing took off for me was the advice that I give to anyone who's doing this now, which is that I knocked on as many doors as possible. I tried to find the places that I thought my writing would be most at home, and politely but persistently kept on knocking on doors until people opened them. And so between doing that on the freelance side, and I had the idea for the Baseball Talmud dating back to college, and trying to find a literary agent, which at that time you couldn't even do online, because the reputable literary agents at that time required a paper proposal.
Yep.
So I still remember with my, I mean, it was my wife before she was my wife. She was my fiance at the time, and we went and weighed how much the proposal cost in postage. It was 87 cents, and we bought 87 cents worth of postage on something like 200 envelopes and sent them out. And finally, I was in the throes of what turned out to be bronchitis, and I had like 103 fever, and I did this phone call from a literary agent who says, hey, I think I can sell this. Are you interested? And still remember I was at like an early freelance assignment parking at Shea Stadium. And I got a call, I mean, talk about dating myself, and I got a call saying, you know, hey, HarperCollins wants it. And that was it, and it sort of went from there. But, and I'm not just saying this because you happen to be the other person on the podcast, but seeing the work you did and, you know, reading the Pinstripe Bible was a big part of why I was thinking, you know, there's a home for me writing about baseball, that there's an opportunity to do this in a fun and interesting and historically in-depth way that I wanted to pursue.
That's very flattering, and it makes me very happy to hear. And it it also, and I'm not just trying to return a compliment, makes me a little envious and a little astonished in the sense that, Howard, I could never do what you do because I am much too shy and inhibited and reclusive to reap what must be, on balance, a whole lot of rejection also, because when you do knock on that many doors, and just as a freelancer in general, editors who have limited budgets and their interests may not always match yours. So you pitch a story you think might be a great idea, and they just say no. And those things, I take them, and I should know better at my age and just as a professional, I take them too personally and I get hurt. So how do you deal with that?
It's interesting. You know, what you're describing to my mind is a feature, not a bug, of the work I do, which is to say that I have a passion for a story when I go to pitch it. I'm not looking to pitch, this team is in town, so I'm just going to write something. And part of this is, and there's no shame in that, but I have significant curiosity about so many different people in so many different areas that I'm really interested in telling a story, a specific story. Well, if one of the editors I write for says no to it, but I were on staff at that publication, that'd be it. There'd be nothing I could do about it. I can go to five other editors and try and find an opportunity to write the story. And I'll give it to you in practice. It happened just this weekend. I really thought it was interesting that the U.S. women's national team in hockey was being honored by U.S. soccer at a U.S. national team soccer game at Red Bull Arena. And I really wanted to talk to some of the players from USA Hockey who were a big part of the fight they had with the parent organization for equal treatment and for, you know, Megan Rapinoe and other leaders on the soccer side. And, you know, do we have a new infrastructure that we are building in women's sports? And so went to several editors. One editor, you know, was over at the New York Times. He happened to be going there himself. So that was a no, not because he wasn't interested in the topic, but very specifically because he was. Other editors I pitched were not interested in the topic. But I found one over at Vice who was, and I got to write the story. And I was really grateful that I got to write the story. But the no's, you know, to my mind, I just sort of put them aside. To my mind, and it's not a personal rejection. You know, editors, like you said, you know, they've finite budgets. They may not be interested when I'm interested. Maybe from the pitch, they didn't see the potential of the story, or maybe I didn't do a good enough job of showing them the potential of the story on the pitch. And so I just, you know, polite thank you, and you know, I come right back. And that's what you have to do in this business in order to succeed. You're not going to succeed as a freelancer. And this was true 5-10 years ago, but it's exponentially more true now. Given that freelance budgets keep getting smaller and budgets as a whole in journalism keep getting smaller, you're not going to get there without consistent, polite, persistent, you know, pursuing of these ideas. And especially when some of my ideas tend to be away from what's considered the quote unquote mainstream, frankly.
So I want to ask you about some of the work that you've done in women's sports, which you just brought up. But I want to start with the Mets because you've written so much about them, and I wonder, with all the different things that you're doing, if there's still an area of consuming interest for you.
That's an interesting question. An area of consuming interest? I find stories interesting, and then I never lose interest in them, by which I mean I wrote about Pat Venditti, the switch pitcher.
Right.
I wrote about him when he was in Trenton with the AA Yankees farm team, and then again when he was in Scranton. And I thought he deserved an opportunity to pitch at the big league level. And then when he did, I got to write a column about what the experience was like for his wife over at USA Today Sports Weekly. And I haven't had the right fit for a story about Pat over the last couple of years, but I am endlessly interested in his career. And that has not disappeared. With the Mets, it's a little different and even a little deeper and longer. Like you said, you know, as someone who grew up as a fervent Mets fan, as someone who is deeply in love with the game of baseball, and also, you know, was very familiar with the ins and outs of what's going on with them on the field, but also, you know, off the field and financially. Yeah, there's this level of interest. What I find fascinating is I get calls from colleagues, you know, who are interested in, you know, what does this mean relative to their financials? And the truth of the matter is, we don't necessarily have a direct way in to finding that out at the moment, by which I mean the reason we had access to so much info and it wasn't necessary to speculate, which is not helpful in any way, is that Mets ownership was sued by the trustee for the Bernie Madoff victims. So all of this was a matter of public record. You know, these were exhibits in a lawsuit you can go grab on Pacer. And so we could piece together and then use reporting to determine where they were and what was going on. We got a second bite at the apple when Lee Castagnini sued Jeff Wilpon for sexual harassment or sexual discrimination. And so there's a way in to doing it that way. Am I still interested? Very much so. I find it really fascinating that there is this yawning chasm between how much a New York team brings in terms of revenue, especially a New York team that owns its own television station, and what the Mets spend on players every single year, because that's ultimately a self-defeating thing and only works to the advantage of Jeff and Fred Wilpon and Saul Katz if they're using that money for personal debts they need to be able to service through interest. But is there a story there? That's a different question. And so if and when there's information, you know, people come to me with information all the time, but it needs to check out, it needs to be accurate, I need to be able to corroborate it. That's a story I'm sure I will pursue again at some point. But I get, you know, on Twitter from time to time, and understandably so, from Mets fans who are saying, gee, you know, what's going on? You should write an update. And it's not as simple as you should write an update. There needs to be that effective information to be able to write an update on.
Well, let me ask you to speculate as much as you're comfortable about their financial situation, because what's interesting to me is that last year, for example, they had a high-ish payroll. They were not up there with the Red Sox and Dodgers and the $200 million teams, but they were close to $180 million. And
I just have to say that's not the case. Like they were, if you include David Wright's salary, which no sentient being should, because David Wright paid 75% by insurance. But if you even included that, their payroll was around $155 million last year, which placed them 12th in baseball. They're in New York City. They are splitting the largest media market by far in baseball, and they were 12th. But even that is absolutely an incomplete way of looking at it. Chop $15 million off that from David Wright's payroll, and then chop off the enormous salaries that they shed in July and August, which, you know, got another $13 to $15 million off their bottom line payroll by the end of it. They were in real dollars, bottom half of the league last year. And yet there was a conversation about the fact that they had somehow stretched beyond their means in order to try and win now. And it was deeply absurd.
All right. So maybe the number that the published figure that I was quoting was maybe an opening day figure that included David Wright, that included all of Neil Walker. And
I don't mean to push back.
I want you to.
I'm saying they have never come close to that. The published figure and the one they kept citing because it was to their best advantage to say, look how much we're spending was 155, which at its best, if you give them every benefit of the doubt, was 12th in the league, 12 of 30. You know, in the nation's largest market as they own their own TV station.
Well, what's fascinating about that is that they've managed to convince some people, including Mets fans, that that's an appropriate number for them to spend. And I know that when I've first guessed them on Twitter, that I have had people say back to me, look, they play in New York, but they're a small market team, which sounds mad to me. But is there any validity to that at all?
No, there's not. But yeah, the easiest answer to your question as to why, is that there is no one on the Mets beat on a regular basis who is contextualizing this. This is not happening. And there are lots of reasons for that, and it's not an explicit criticism of the people who cover the Mets on an everyday basis. But I will tell you a couple of things. Number one, I happen to know from multiple, you know, these guys are colleagues of mine, and some of them are friends of mine, and they flat out told me there is blowback if you write about this. If you write about this, you will not be given information by the Mets for scoop X, Y, or Z. So that's number one. And number two, and you can argue whether this is reasonable or even an accurate or effective way to fulfill the job of beat reporter, there is the idea that it is uncomfortable to walk in the next day if you have written a story that is critical of what the Mets are doing on the business side of things. And that is just a reality. And number three, and you know, this is not universal, but is the case in some instances, there are business relationships between the Mets and some of the publications that cover them. And so that impacts the ability or willingness for some of those publications to go after the Mets and be able to give it a clear shot. But number four, and this is by far the biggest one, covering a baseball team as a beat reporter right now is, when the baseball team is merely a baseball team, it is a full-time job. You are, it is a more than a full-time job. It's a 24/7 job. You are covering lineups. You are covering pregame information. You are covering stuff that's going on during the game. You are looking to, in the midst of the day-to-day grind, write about features. You are trying to, if you can help it, try and get into deeper trends of the team as a baseball team. The New York Mets, though, over the past decade, have not been a baseball team. They have been a baseball team as, in many ways, a cover for an active business and legal entanglement. And so if you are so busy doing the job of beat reporter well, it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to go deep diving into what's going on from a legal, financial, and frankly, ethical point of view. It is a difficult thing to do. Everything is allied against it. And so what are people reading? People are reading coverage every day that does not take this reality into account. And so it's not a surprise to me that therefore there are people who are buying into that idea, you know, who are repeating that idea. We're certainly across the political spectrum as well, seeing that as a fact, that if you see something reported over and over again, if people are, you know, being drilled in a certain way, that that's going to be what conclusion they reach, but it doesn't make it true.
So we're almost, what, 10 years past the revelation of the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme?
December 11th, 2008. Is correct.
So, and this, of course, took in the Will Pons and the Saul Katz, who is partnered with them. Mm-hmm. Is what you're saying is, and this isn't surprising given the amount of money involved, that they, whether personally or as they have dragged the Mets as a business into it, are still not clear of those entanglements or the debt?
Clearly not. Here's what we know for sure, which is that when their Bernie Madoff money went poof in the night, and we're talking hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, they borrowed against their ownership stake in the Mets and their ownership stake in SNY in order to survive, because essentially a lot of what they owned, they had leveraged using their Bernie Madoff money. So you have to have something to leverage against. And in that case, it was these loans. And unless they have, since litigation ended, found a way to pay off the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in loans they were continuing to spend interest on, they are servicing that debt along with the debt against Citi Field every single year. That number from a few years ago was north of $100 million. It was effectively a second payroll that went to just servicing the debt. It's not paying down the debt, so it's not going anywhere, but servicing the interest on the debt before you got to dollar one that you were spending on the team. And so that is the reality that they continue to face. And as long as Major League Baseball is going to be okay with that, they'll continue to do it. Of course, to their immense relief, I am sure, Major League Baseball has not only been okay with it with the Mets now for a significant period of time, they're clearly okay with other teams essentially using their franchises as debt vehicles. That's why the current ownership of the Miami Marlins is in place. And so in a remarkable way, and our friend David Roth wrote about this in a really excellent way over at Deadspin a few weeks ago, talking about how basically the entire league has become the Mets. That the market, I mean, you know, everyone laughed at this for years and years when the Mets were, we'll wait for the market to come to us. And then teams would sign players because that's what teams are supposed to do. And the Mets would, oh my God, I can't believe it that player X got paid because baseball teams make lots and lots of money and want to win. And now it seems as if a significant portion of Major League Baseball has bought into the idea of, well, gee, if it was good enough for the Mets, well, why don't we go ahead and do it too?
What Bud Selig accomplished going back, and I've talked about this frequently on the podcast, is that I think through essentially special pleading on his own behalf as owner of the Milwaukee Brewers at the time, through revenue sharing, he made baseball safe for mediocrity and for leveraging teams for other purposes other than building winning baseball clubs over time. And I don't think until now, at least I appreciated just how much damage he had done to the sport through what seems at first like kind of a reasonable thing. Like, you know, you can't have a Yankee schedule without opposing teams. And if the opposing teams are just paper tigers, then it's not good for the game. Like all of that makes sense on the surface. But the deeper ramifications of it are you don't have to try anymore.
I wonder if Randy Levine, if you asked him like deep down, do you think there should be other baseball teams or just the Yankees? I feel like no, you know what? We're good. Let's just, I mean, really, you know.
We'll just play split squad every
center field. But yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, we can blame Bud to a certain extent, but also the rod of the MLBPA plays a critical part in the fact that and I'm not sure there's a full understanding of this on the Players Association's part, but you've seen this in other sports as well. If you do not have a union advancing, it is by definition retreating. And that is what has happened. And so now, you know, they're finally trying to stand their ground. And, I am, let me say, skeptical that Tony Clark, who I have pointed out on Twitter, once lost a negotiation with Mr. Met and some Queen school children over the right to wear double zero when he was a member of the Mets, is the man to do it. But the Major League Baseball Players Association, by virtue of not continuing forward, has allowed the owners the upper hand. And it may be difficult to reverse that process. But that is a critical change that we are seeing in the game. And it's very strange because for differing reasons, Rob Manfred for reasons of wanting to cover for the owners who are his employer, and Tony Clark for reasons of not wanting to seem as if he has been scammed, which he has, we're both very comfortable saying over the last couple of years, players are not receiving a diminished percentage of revenue from baseball when it doesn't take very long on a calculator to see that's not true.
So just to the extent that we can talk about the winter that the Mets had from a baseball point of view, what do you think about it? Because what strikes me as kind of odd is they took advantage of the moribund free agent market to bring back Jay Bruce. They signed Adrian Gonzalez. They signed Todd Frazier, Jason Vargas, Anthony Swarzak, and they also picked up the option on Asdrubal Cabrera, who didn't seem that happy to be there. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the team hasn't exactly rebuilt. It's actually gotten really old. Mm-hmm. And what they seem to be counting on, and I mean, it's looked mostly nice in spring training so far, but they're counting on Noah Syndergaard being healthy and Matt Harvey rebounding and all kinds of health from those starting pitchers and all these old guys remaining viable for another year. It's a long shot, especially in a division with the Nationals, but And again, I'm sure this must be an outgrowth of, again, the kind of payroll and flexibility that they have, but they're neither fish nor fowl right now. They, in fact, may be, in a way, in terms of positioning for future seasons, worse off than they were before.
You are looking at a team, and this sort of reinforces it, what I've talked about other places in previous stories, which is that they, for all their talk about we're waiting for the market to come back to us, the reality is this was never about a plan, about a 2-3 year build or a 5-year build, or, you know, the way the good teams do it. And they think about, you know, tomorrow and the next day and the day after that. It is fundamentally about, you know, what can Sandy Alderson get ownership to sign off on at any given moment? And the needs and desires of the baseball team are by definition subsidiary to what ownership needs personally to get through the year and from year to year. But also to the preferences of ownership, which is to say that when it is players that they know, they are far likelier to sign off on an expenditure that goes along with it. So they're limited in two ways over and over again. It's why you see the type of continuity that you see from the Mets. And so continuity is the nice polite word to slap on it, but that's the reality of it. You know, what is going to convince Fred to let that money go? And so it's not just it's limited and it's far lower than it should be for the market, but it's limited by the limited eyesight, let us say, of ownership as well. And listen, they caught lightning in a bottle. And it worked out for them in 2015. And, you know, what's interesting to me is I think it's fair to wonder what the public perception would be had that not happened. A lot of unlikely things needed to take place. It's not as if the Mets believed when they added Yoenis Cespedes in July of 2015 that he would manage to play better than anyone in the National League and that they would go on such a streak while Washington faltered that they would manage to win the division. That was essentially a small sample size, 2 months of great play and enjoy it. I mean, you know, more power to them for having that moment, but it doesn't reflect any sort of consistent plan. I mean, you compare it to, you know, someone like the Houston Astros, for instance, and the Astros won the World Series last year because some things really went right, but their baseline was a long-term build around talent that is going to have them, if you go from, say, the median expectation, they're going to be better this year than they were last year. They may not win the World Series, but they don't need some sort of 99th percentile performance from a whole bunch of players in order to be really, really good. And as you correctly pointed out, the Mets need not necessarily a 99th percentile performance from their players, but 99th percentile in health in order for this to happen, whether you're talking about previously injured pitchers or older position players, both of whom are disproportionately likely to get hurt.
Heard a sermon, what a sermon, preached by Parson Brown, tell it to ya, tell it to ya. Told each mister, told each sister, time to settle down. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Potatoes are cheaper, tomatoes are cheaper. Now's the time to fall in love. Why, the butcher, the baker, the old candlestick maker gave their price a downward shove. Grab yourself someone to fry your eggs and bacon. She can live just like a queen on what you're making. You'll find it sunshine or trouble, you're better off doubtful. Now's the time to fall in love.
Steve here, interrupting the multifarious old-time star Eddie Cantor with the only hit song that I'm aware of that's about deflation, Now's the Time to Fall in Love, from 1931. It was written by the partnership of Al Sherman and Al Lewis, Al Sherman was the dad of the Sherman Brothers, who would later go on to write a whole lot of famous songs for Disney, including All That Stuff and Mary Poppins. This seemed like an appropriate song, both for the Mets and an off-season market that has Jake Arrieta out there begging for scraps. We'll take a break for a word from our sponsors, and then I'll be right back with more Howard Megdal.
Now's the time to fall in love. But talkie seemed tender to make us surrender.
I've said in the past that they should trade Cespedes instead of keeping him on. And I brought this up to Jesse Spector on one installment of this show, and he said essentially, I don't know how many times you can kick the same fan base in the groin. But at $29 million a pop this year, if they're really limited to $150 million, he's 20% of the payroll by himself. I don't see how that's viable. And as great as he is, as much fun as he can be, he is a guy who long-term has had trouble staying healthy.
The problem is there's not a budget. They're not set at a budget. No one's going to Sandy Alderson in ownership and saying, you can spend this amount of money. It is player by player, and it changes month by month, and it changes based on meetings they're having, you know, that have nothing to do with baseball. So if I'm Sandy Alderson, and to be frank, I happen to know this is the way in which they approach it. If you can get an expenditure on a player and increase your talent base, you do it, period. If you can get the money for Jason Vargas, you go get Jason Vargas. And it's not about what that money is going to look like in 2019 or 2020, because even the people who are giving them the money either don't know or are not sharing that information. And so when it comes to Cespedes, if you got ownership to shell out for it, and you have someone who's capable like that, you don't trade him because, you know, the idea that you're going to get dollar for dollar, the ability to spend $29 million elsewhere on payroll, it's just not how it works. It's just not how it works here.
So it occurs to me to ask, you mentioned that the organization will push back on the beat writers when they write stuff about the actual financial status of the Mets. You've written a book about it and other things like that. Have you heard directly or indirectly whether the Wilpons are fans of yours?
yes, I have. And they didn't love the book, and obviously were not pleased with the reporting that I did about that. But to be frank, that's not really my concern. My concern is, am I fair and am I accurate about this? And when I've gotten pushback on it, my response has always been, you know, show me what's inaccurate and I'd be happy to correct it. And, you know, the day that happens, I will certainly make whatever changes are necessary. But that has never actually led to anyone pointing out something that was inaccurate or needed to change.
You've written a great deal about women's sports. You have the Summit Hoops site, which is about the WNBA. I think your most recent article was profiling the upcoming draft for that.
And college too. We're women's college hoops. We have international, high school, world of women's basketball, just for what it's worth.
And you've written about other women's sports as well. And I should have looked for the women's curling articles that must have happened during the Olympics if you weren't too busy. I would have enjoyed those if you didn't do them.
I'm writing about food, but not yet women's curling.
Well, there's another thing for you to aspire to. I love curling. The first time I saw Curling Night in America light up on NBC, I was actually thrilled. I think it's a great game and a fun game to watch. But be that as it may, yeah. I want to ask you just a very basic question about this, which is, I've always been confused by why women's sports always seem to be kind of a secondary to men's sports. It seems to me that these are the same games in a large sense. These are high level athletics, and yes, the nuances of some of the games, the speed, the way that they may adjust difficulty for some of the differing physical capabilities between men and women may change those games slightly, but these are still wonderful performances to watch on many occasions. And is it just that sports was exclusively the domain of, or at least the big ticket sports, the big dollar sports were exclusively the domain of male athletes for most of a century, that people still haven't accommodated themselves to the idea that women's sports have as much validity and as much viewer interest as men's sports do?
So I think there's a lot of reasons, a lot of answers, and some of them are pernicious and some of them are not. But there are a lot of reasons, I think, why these gaps exist on the coverage side of things. So I'll try and make this as brief as I can by sort of addressing a few of the big ones, right? So number one is that much of how the media covers sports was set in stone decades ago, and where the beats were created were done over a long period of time in newspapers around the country and have been passed down. And so during periods of time when men's sports sprung up, that coincided with the growth and establishment of newspapers. So you think about the history of baseball. When did baseball become a national game and something where box scores were in the newspapers? I mean, you know this as well as anyone. It's the early part of the 20th century. The NFL was nothing in the early part of the 20th century. It was founded in 1925. There's a great sports writer named Frank Fitzpatrick who goes and does Philadelphia history over at the Inquirer. And he's written about the NFL draft when it was held in Philadelphia, not most recently, but back in the 1930s. And it was this patchwork affair that, you know, makes the WNBA draft look extremely sophisticated by contrast. But it happened during the 1930s. By the 50s, you know, by the time you get Colts Giants on national TV, newspapers understood, picked it up, and football became a regular part of coverage. Well, when are we seeing women's sports, especially at the professional level, grow and develop? There's a legacy of covering college women's sports that is significantly greater. In fact, people talk about this. Maya Moore wrote a great piece in the Players Tribune a couple years ago where she talked about the coverage that she saw at UConn and it disappears when she gets to the WNBA. Well, let's think about that. College sports and college women's college sports really grew exponentially in the years and decades following Title IX. Well, that's 1972. Well, from 1972 through the mid to late 1990s, that's still a growth period for newspapers. So, okay, Title IX comes along, and with it you get coverage of things like Pat Summitt's Lady Vols in Tennessee, and what Gino Auriemma started to build in UConn. You see that across the board for women's college sports. Women's professional sports, well, that's a different question, right? On the soccer side, what's the big breakthrough? 1999 and the 99ers and Brandi Chastain's goal. The WNBA debuts following the 96 Olympics. Well, now cross-check that against where the industry is. Well, the industry was into a death spiral by the end of the 1990s and into the early 2000s. Nobody was investing in new areas of coverage. In fact, what everyone was doing was cutting back. So you have, to begin with, the fact that there was no legacy for the coverage. In addition to that, you have the fact that, in fact, things are getting cut. So nobody is in the experimentation mood. Everyone is just trying to hold on to the status quo. And then you have the additional, and this is not a small thing. It's very hard to pinpoint exactly what percentage of it is, but you have the fact that disproportionately you have men making these decisions. And so to the extent that it is people fearing for their jobs and simply unable or, you know, for reasons of budgets or unwilling to do things a different way, there's never an investment that goes along with that. Well, an absence of coverage is death for anything, just absolutely anything. And so when we know, and there was a USC massive survey of this over a long period of time, but I mean, you know this just by virtue of open up any website or pick up any newspaper, that there is a tiny fraction of women's sports coverage for what happens with the men. you're not going to see people supported in the same way. In fact, what's miraculous really is, you know, think about the NBA versus the WNBA. Well, WNBA averaged about 7,600 fans per game last year. There are reasons why it's not apples to apples compared to the NBA. Some of the arenas are smaller, for instance. So even just potential capacity was somewhat limited. But let's just call it apples to apples. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5 times as many people go to an average NBA game as WNBA game. Well, are there 2.5 articles on the NBA for every WNBA article? Of course not. It's 100 to 1, 200 to 1. You know, I was looking recently, I was speaking to a bit of a retrograde editor at one of the New York dailies on Twitter, who was insisting to me that, you know, this way just no one cares about women's sports, you know, contra lots of evidence. There were something like 280 articles written about the St. John's men's basketball team, a college team, that draws less than the New York Liberty. And in the same publication, there were 4 New York Liberty articles written over that time. So the attention is such that there's a massive gap that does not reflect what is a gap in overall attendance that is driven in large part, I would argue, by a massive media gap. So, you know, it's sort of a roundabout way of describing it, but that's the unfortunate thing. It's a chicken and egg argument as well. But there are lots of reasons why it happens, why it has happened. It also means that exactly none of those reasons are good arguments for it continuing to happen. And in fact, what I believe ultimately is there's a huge underserved market out there of stories not being covered and people who wish to read about it. And ultimately, we will see that gap addressed, not because it is the ethically correct thing to do, although it is, and not because there are tremendous underreported and unreported stories out there that from a journalism perspective ought to be told, although that is a really good reason, but it'll happen because there's money to be made. And ultimately it'll happen for the same reason that just about any equality or any inequality gets addressed in this country, is that ultimately there is a financial incentive and the right people are going to figure that out. And it's just a matter of time.
I don't know if I'll ask this question the right way, but when you look at, I mean, social media is the wrong thing to go off of, but I see people denigrate female athletes. I see them put down their performances in comparison to the men's, which in a way is just inept. I mean, they should just be, you know, treated as their own thing. They don't need to be compared directly. Do you ever, when you step into a WNBA event or women's soccer event or any other thing that you cover, does it ever even occur to you to say to yourself, well, I'm doing something that's ghettoized, that I'm attending something that's minor league compared to if I were at an NBA game or a men's soccer game?
It doesn't. And there's two parts to that that I always find particularly amusing. I understand why you're asking the question, but the first part is that the question is asked in that way, not by you, but in general, but in the way that it is denigrated, because everything has to be through the prism of as it relates to men. It is amazing how much of our social construct is based around the idea of we can only evaluate what a woman is doing or what a woman has accomplished relative to a man. And it's, you know, I mean, there's larger questions here as well in terms of success in the business world. There's questions of, you know, how women are talked about aesthetically in our society. But it is always, always, always done through that prism and in a way that I just don't understand. And I guess the easiest way for me to describe that is I would just turn it around and you never hear it described this way, right? But how many times do you hear a high school football reporter asked, gee, I know you're at this high school game in Texas, but do you ever feel like when you walk in there, I mean, these players, they're not as good as the NFL players, you know? Like, why are you bothering to cover a Friday night football game in Texas? Why are you bothering to go to the SEC showdown where quite frankly, almost all of those players are not good enough to play in the NFL. I mean, doesn't that bother you? Don't you feel like it's a very minor league? And so if that question is not asked, then the follow-up is, all right, why? Why is that question not asked? And the reason why is that in our society, there is not a need to ultimately view every 19-year-old boy through the prism of men. But for some reason, there is a significant part of our society, and for lots of reasons, that has to view anything a woman says or does or accomplishes through the prism of a man.
That's a fantastic answer. And that was kind of the answer that I was hoping for, because I really don't understand it, as you apparently don't, when people take that posture. And I just referenced the Winter Olympics.
I understand it.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt. I understand. I understand what you're saying. I'm saying I understand why they do it. I wonder whether they do sometimes.
Yeah, no, I don't think so, because it doesn't need to be that way. Everything should be its own thing. And what I was going to say about the Winter Olympics, because you have such wall-to-wall coverage, this massive event that just ended a couple of weeks ago, you can turn it on and you get more or less equal coverage of men's and women's sports. So if you happen to turn it on at the right moment, you might see men's snowboarding halfpipe, or you might see women's snowboarding halfpipe. And if you just view either event in isolation, you see these athletes doing amazing, death-defying things. And at no time does it or should it occur to you to say, oh, well, you know, the fact that a man is doing three rotations in the air, a woman is doing three rotations in the air, they're just amazing regardless. Same thing, men's biathlon, women's biathlon, whatever. They're skiing, they're shooting, they're doing stuff. Figure skating is obviously its own thing. But again, you know, you have men's and women's and pairs, and everybody does these awesomely excellent things. In that environment, the comparison doesn't come up. It's only when, for some reason, when you ask somebody to watch a WNBA game that they get their, or at least some men seem to just reflexively get their noses out of joint about what female athletes might be capable of.
Well, and ask yourself, just from a journalism perspective, what is the argument to not cover the WNBA? If you have a professional team in town, and a professional team in town that is drawing thousands of people on a regular basis, what would possibly be the reason not to cover them? You know, there's, and just so interesting to me, you know, while you have to come up with such a tortured set of reasons, you know, well, they don't draw as well as the NBA in town, you know, is one such argument. It's like, all right, but they're a professional team that draws thousands of fans and does better than college teams. Why are you covering the college team more, you know, when it's about, well, they have to win? You know, when you look at what the Minnesota Lynx do, Minnesota Lynx are a dynasty. And the fact that the Lynx, I have to go back and crunch the numbers, but there were some periods of time where the Lynx playing a 34-game schedule won about as much as the Timberwolves did playing an 82-game schedule. All right, so it's not about winning. The Minnesota Twins are covered no matter what, but you're going to set this artificial barrier to entry for covering the Lynx. I remember there was a piece that was written in the Washington Post last year. And the Post, to their credit, by the way, does a ton of great coverage of women's sports. They had Jean Juan was on the Mystics and Maryland women's basketball beat for a long time. They replaced him with Ava Wallace, who was just like, killing it, covering those topics as well. But somebody wrote a column in there talking about all the men's basketball teams were struggling last March. So maybe it's time for the Maryland women to have their moment. And all I could think as I'm reading this is, you're at a daily newspaper. The idea that someone needs to have a moment. And by the way, this wasn't like, oh, wow, the surprising women's basketball team at Maryland and Brenda Freeze finally doing well. Like, they won it all in 2006. Like, they've been great for a long time. But the only way that they're going to break through and have a moment is if everyone else is off the court. That's the only chance that they have to do it. That's the standard that we're setting for coverage. No one can really answer me why.
Well, there's like a chicken and an egg argument there too, which is we don't cover it because it doesn't draw, but it doesn't draw because we don't cover it.
And by the way, when you don't cover it, or you cover it sporadically or every once in a while, what have you done? I mean, you need to build up coverage through building a habit. And so if your coverage is once every 3 months, the people who would be interested aren't even looking to you to get it, number one. And number two, you're probably not providing the type of coverage that people who are interested in go back to it. I've had this experience so many different times at WNBA practices college press conferences, where somebody comes in and it's not a women's basketball writer. It's somebody who's low man on the totem pole. It's usually a man. And you'll get asked a question like, who's the star of this team? And so the question that gets asked, and I love this question. I mean love in like the deeply disingenuous way that I am saying. I hope that comes across. Is
yes.
Talk about what this team is about for someone who is just learning about them now. There's some variation on that question. And it's just, I don't know what to ask you. And so I'm going to ask for a guide to dummies for your particular team. And then I'm going to print it. And anybody who has spent any time watching that team, and if the Daily Paper sends somebody out to you, you've probably had enough success that an editor has begrudgingly said, all right, we better send somebody out to cover this. That team has had a ton of success. Nobody who cares about that team is going to read that article.
Hypothetically speaking, if me and my close personal friend Warren Buffett wanted to go out and back a revival of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, and mm-hmm. say we don't compete with the major leagues, maybe we play a fall and winter schedule in warm weather sites, would the support be out there for that? Do you think that that's something that could be a viable enterprise to interest people in a professional women's baseball league?
Look, I believe so. I believe there is talent there. I think there is a need, by the way, to build infrastructure for baseball in a way that we don't have to build it on the soccer side and on the basketball side, because Title IX has helped to create that up through the collegiate level. What's happened on the baseball side, and our friend Emma Spann wrote about this in the New York Times a couple years ago, but it bears repeating, is that women who play baseball are disproportionately shunted into softball, which right. is a different sport. So do I think there would be support for it? Absolutely, I do. I think it would be a more difficult lift from a personnel perspective simply because of that. That's the difference between that and other women's sports that have professional needs as of right now. But do I think it's doable? Absolutely. And then it all comes down to, you know, you talk about Warren Buffett or, you know, any other rich person, how much runway can you provide and what can you do to build an infrastructure of coverage and support for it? And that is the question with any women's sport. It's not any mystery why NWSL, the National Women's Soccer League, has done better than previous professional leagues. And one is that ownership is more stable, and that matters in anything you do, and you know, men's or women's sport, any business. And that's number one. And number two, the advent of social media and the ability to find an audience independent of the coverage in the daily paper has allowed a greater audience to build, even if it is not as large as it would be if we had anything approaching parity in coverage between men's and women's sports.
I must try to make the man love me. Make the man love me now. By and by, I'll make the man happy. I badly I want him just as he is. May I say that should the man ask me, I'll be his.
Steve here, interrupting the great Peggy Lee with her version of Make the Man Love Me from the 1951 Broadway musical A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Lyrics by Dorothy Fields, music by Arthur Schwartz, both songwriting Hall of Famers, used here as ironic counterpoint to our discussion. In the show, it's used even more poignantly, a wife and mother desperately trying to outcompete alcohol for her husband's affections. We'll take one last quick break, and then we'll be back to wrap up the conversation with Howard Megdahl.
So I pray to heaven above me, pray until day grows dim, for a way to make the man love me as I love him.
So the most ambitious thing I feel like you're doing right now, anyway, you can tell me that it's not the most ambitious thing, is that you have recently founded a new publication, 50 States of Blue. As you observed beforehand, I did do this knowingly. I keep wanting to call it 50 Shades of Blue, which I guess would be politics with nipple clamps. That is not what this is. But why don't you tell us, tell us what it is before we talk about what it isn't.
Well, so 50 States of Blue, we're addressing a couple of things that I see on the political side of the journalism coverage, which is to say there are a ton of good journalists doing excellent work at nonpartisan, unaffiliated publications. But there is an enormous gap between the coverage there, which has a certain implicit bias, and I say bias not right or left sense, but there's a certain self-selection when it comes to what topics are being covered and the way they're being covered and who is being talked about as stakeholders within that coverage, and as compared to a lot of things on the left that need greater exploration. We are seeing a significant and well-funded by, you know, shadowy means infrastructure on the right. And so there was this Pew Research poll that came out last year, and it was basically trying to measure, all right, how is Donald Trump being covered on the left and the right? And on the right, you know, there was Breitbart and, you know, Daily Wire and The Federalist and all these different publications. And on the left, you know, they used, for instance, the New York Times. And, you know, full disclosure, I've freelanced for the New York Times. I am a lifetime subscriber to the New York Times. I have a tremendous amount of respect for it. But as the Times would be the first to tell you, they are not an outlet of the left. They're just not. And what they are is an outlet that is read by the left. And that is what Pew needed to cite instead. And so having an outlet that was unapologetically making it clear, look, you know, this is the progressive direction we think the country should go in, but we are not some sort of parallel of the right trying to put forward propaganda. We are trying to say this is our explicit set of beliefs, and here are the arguments for our analysis, and here's the information, and here's where it's coming from. It frees us up to do things in some fundamentally different ways than, to be frank, you know, even some people at the Times, who I'm sure would love to do things this way, have the opportunity to do so. And so if that is an issue at the national level, and I believe it is, and there are terrific outlets like Think Progress and others that, you know, do a lot of this work, it is even greater at the state level, where a lot of even the basic blocking and tackling of reporting is not being done by newspapers that have had to cut back and cut back and cut back again. And so we have state correspondents in over half the states, and ultimately, you know, by the middle of this year, we plan to have in all 50 states on the ground in these states, being able to talk to people directly and spotlight these stories and address, you know, for instance, when there's a strike in West Virginia, not just some sort of view from 30,000 feet, or what does the governor say? But as Tamar Auber was able to do for us at 50 States of Blue, talk about it in a fundamental way from the ground, from the point of view of the teachers. What are the real challenges that they are facing, and be able to report in that way?
How has the reaction been so far?
Reaction's been really positive. There's been a real understanding that this is a mission that is desperately needed, that this is an ability to go in greater depth on the issues that matter to people. And I've been just really heartened by, you know, our podcast. We have different conversations with progressive challengers running in 2018. And that's allowed us to talk not just about, you know, gee, will Dems win the House in 2018, which, by the way, is, you know, a going concern, is not a small thing, given who the president of the United States is, and given the extent to which the GOP Congress has done nothing at an elementary level to rein him in. I don't just mean from a policy perspective, but I mean from a corruption perspective. But, you know, we'll talk to a guy like Andrew Jans, who's running against Devin Nunes, and we're not just talking to him about, you know, whatever idiotic thing Nunes said on Fox, but also talking about the challenges facing his particular rural California district. And so getting the opportunity to shed light on these issues, Chase Woodruff is doing a wonderful job of not just pointing out what Republicans are doing in the state of Colorado, but the failings of Democrats toward their own people representing. And, you know, pushing that conversation in a progressive direction in and of itself matters and means we are doing something that is not about tribalism. And it's about calling people to account for a slice of the country that is not often heard.
Without subjecting you to a Wilpons-like inspection of your budget and so forth, I want to make it clear I'm not asking that. But the financial aspects of online publishing, as we've been talking about, are very, very harsh. And as you said, local coverage is the first thing that papers cut back. So how is it that or have you found it to be a thing that is financially viable to do? And are you finding a national audience for these stories that you're approaching from a local basis?
There's a deep passion for it. And so it is going to be up to us to convert that into, number one, an audience, which has everything to do with making sure that the people that we believe care about this know about it. And I think, you know, this sort of goes back to the women's sports conversation, but it's anything else. You need to show up, you need to do the good work, and you need to build an audience that way by building trust. And that takes time. And there's no question about that. But then also to go ahead and monetize that. It's my belief that if we do number one, that number two will follow. But, you know, obviously we're going to have to go and prove it.
I think it's a wonderful thing. And the thing that you said about this not being tribalism, I think, is immensely valuable, because what we don't need, whether left or right, and despite the right having been talking about a left-wing media conspiracy for at least the last 30-some years, the voices on the
left,
yeah, it's, they're vastly outweighed, actually. I mean, the voices.
Billy Graham, if I may point out, the man who was honored at the Rotunda, who was on tape talking about the extent to which Jews were the problem, and that while he was smiling in the face of Jews, that he had a very different opinion of them behind the scenes. Something worth
reading. Yeah, and something that he and Nixon reinforced each other on. Nixon also not being the greatest fan of Jews. You know how it is, Howard, with the worldwide Jewish conspiracy. I've never gotten my check, and I just don't know if they've lost my address or what it is.
I'll make sure that gets out to you today.
Oh, well, I didn't realize that you had the ear of the accountant, so I greatly appreciate that. But I do think that we need less tribalism and more just persuasion. And, I mean, education is everything, and I don't mean literally in the reading, writing, and arithmetic part, although that's important too, but simply trying to convert the unconverted, not to left, not to right, but to just the greatest good for the greatest number of people.
There's no question about it. And again, all of that comes back to a simple question, which is, if you believe in progressive ideals and progressive ideas, do you allow them to be defined by some propaganda outlet on the right? Or do you come forward and say, you know, look, this is not some straw man. Here are the people who believe this. Here's how they are specifically affected. And, you know, here's how to learn about it on a daily basis. And there are, you know, just from a content perspective, we have never lacked for stories to tell.
And that really, again, comes down to energizing people and persuasion. And, you know, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but back, my father did not believe in cable television initially for some reason. And so I consumed a lot of baseball on the radio, and I consumed it, Yankees baseball on WABC in New York. And very often leading into the Yankees games was Bob Grant, who was this sort of primordial Rush Limbaugh figure. And being a kid and not knowing any better, I would just park the radio on that station waiting for the Yankees game to come on. And every day I might hear a couple of hours of this guy. And it's kind of a miracle that I didn't grow up into somebody who was at the very least a cultural conservative. And I can remember in particular his rantings against homosexuals, which today would be scandalous. But his tagline, he used to end every program by saying, "Your influence counts, use it." And that's the only part of it I still agree with. But as long as we're passive and we're on the couch and we just, even if we're on the side that you and I are on and we just watch MSNBC every night and nod along with Chris Hayes or Rachel Maddow, we haven't accomplished a damn thing except to boost their ratings.
That's very true. And again, informationally, it has to be, I need more complicated than I should say, which is to say we can boost their ratings, but also the more knowledgeable that we are, the better able we are to apply pressure in the pressure points that are most effective at moving legislators, at moving the public, at changing conversations in favor of, you know, progressive positions, you know, gun control being a great example of that most recently. But again, it's, I believe, a fundamental problem in this country when people are not fully informed. And I don't think you're going to be fully informed without a broader spectrum represented. Moreover, if the only spectrum represented is the center left and the increasingly far right, well, the center of gravity is going to keep changing and it's going to move in the rightward shift.
I agree with that completely. And just to close this out, because it was a story that was on your front page, when we have to ask why Democrats are supporting a rollback of Dodd-Frank, it points out, and for those who are not following closely, that's about banking regulation in the aftermath of the 2008 crash that protects us all from, for one thing, having to kick in for another taxpayer bailout of these huge institutions. It points out that never mind opposition to the right or counterbalancing the right, that we have work to do on our own side in terms of educating the public in on what their own representatives are doing and keeping those guys honest. Because honestly, the most difficult part of being somebody who is a pragmatist, who is for ethical government and like I said, the most utilitarian government, is that the Democrats are as bought and paid for on some occasions as the Republicans are.
There is nothing wrong with, and that will be a new phase that, God willing, will enter sooner than later. But there is nothing wrong with using activism to make sure the people who you help get elected adhere to the things that you want. And the right is extremely good at this. And to be frank, the left was not even particularly good at rising up and preventing it, which is how we ended up with Donald Trump and a GOP House and GOP Senate. And so I have been extremely heartened by the kind of activism that has taken place since 2016. I think it will be very much to our benefit, and I think we'll, you're seeing in special elections all over the country, and all the best statistical modelers are saying that that indicates a wave is coming. Now, if a wave comes and Democrats hold a majority in the House and Senate next year, then activism has to shift into a different gear. And Democrats need to make sure that, and Barack Obama's talked about this, the energy that led to his election in 2008 was not harnessed, and it dissipated and it disappeared. And so instead of saying, now he's elected, now we are in power, now we hold majorities, now these things need to get done, they disappeared and the Tea Party held the floor. And the net results have been precisely what we've seen. And so, you know, card check was not voted in by Democrats who easily could have done so, you know, for instance. And gun control was not a priority. And we've seen the tragic effects that followed. So it is all well and good to see that happen here right now, but we won't, and I say we, not just in terms of 50 states of blue, but in a broader sense, we need to be fully informed on the left in such a way that people are held to account come 2019 as well.
Howard, I'll tell you, I'm very tempted to follow up on that, and I would love to talk about how Obama did or did not manage his coalition, but I've already kept you long, and that's not only a whole other hours-long conversation, it's possibly a whole other podcast series. So I will...
All the reason for us to go to Harold's and get a sandwich.
Yeah, exactly. That, and those are large sandwiches. And again, to cover all the facets of that 8 years, you might need an overlarge sandwich to really get through it. So we will...
The knish, that's all. Nothing important.
And you know, when we were walking out the last time, I noticed the black and white cookies, which are easily the size of 18-wheeler tires. So yeah, all of the above, because it's an involved conversation, and I look forward to having it. But for now, I very much want to thank you for doing this. I've been looking forward to talking to you for a long time, and you know so much about so many things that it would be so easy to keep going, not just on sports and politics, but soon cooking. So I'm looking forward to that. Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you in any realm, under any circumstances. So thanks for having me.
By the foul-mouthed bear barons of Arsinia, we have come to the end of another program. You can follow Howard Megdal on Twitter at Howard Megdal. Spell that M-E-G-D-A-L. Very straightforward. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because Grow Stephen Goldman risks diagnosis of morbid obesity. And of course, you can write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And please rate us at the podcatcher of your choice, iTunes, Stitcher, what have you. It's all appreciated. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 9. Our producer is Dane Orridge Washington. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have been hearing throughout the episode along with some other stuff, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. If you like Rick's music, let me know. Maybe we can start a hashtag, WriteMoreRick, and he'll spend more time at the keyboard. Well, if Mike Trout doesn't change his name to Mike Blobfish and insist he'll only play for the Great Lakes Pescatarians, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.